Well, in this first part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Afghanistan. A new report scheduled for release after next month's election paints a very bleak picture for the future of Afghanistan. This report questions the ability of the Afghan government to counter the growing influence of the Taliban, to deal with corruption and also with the drug trade. This morning on this hour of Focus 580, we'll be trying to get you an update on the current situation in Afghanistan. And our guest for the program is Mark Mazzetti. He is national security correspondent for The New York Times. Certainly, if you read the paper, you've seen his articles. If you haven't, you can go to their website and you can see some of the things that he's written. And of course, questions are welcome. Anybody is welcome to join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments so we can keep things moving. But of course, anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Mazzetti, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. I know you're busy. I'm sure you have plenty of things to do, and we're glad you can be with us. The thing I suppose I'd like to start with is this story that you contributed to that was in the paper not very long ago about a draft report of an intelligence assessment of the situation in Afghanistan. It's in process. Final report will be released sometime next month, or at least after the election. And it certainly does seem to paint a rather bleak picture of the future here and the current situation and of the future. Just can you talk just a little bit about who's putting this report together, where it's coming from?
Sure. What it is a what they call a national intelligence estimate, which is a assessment by the 16 different intelligence agencies in the U.S. government that they come out periodically. And actually, just to clarify, it probably will not end up being published to the public. They sometimes do them, but there's now a new practice where they're trying to not release them publicly because they are not meant for the public. They're meant for people in government to make decisions, and they worry that if they release them to the public, then they're written sort of in a way for public release. But this one is really meant to sort of take a snapshot in what is happening in Afghanistan now and what the trends are for the future. It is, as we reported last week, it's still in its draft form, but it's pretty much done. And its assessment of the political and economic and security situation in Afghanistan. As we reported, it's a bleak picture. It's it takes a fairly dim view of the ability of President Hamid Karzai's government to not only sort of stop the encroachment of the Taliban around Afghanistan, but also to sort of take direct aim at Mr. Karzai's government for political corruption there and the cronyism in the government and the inability really to extend its reach outside or far beyond the capital of Kabul. It also sort of talks about the impact of the drug trade and how this is fueling the corruption, and it's also providing a tremendous amount of economic incentive to continue this these sort of payoffs and that type of thing. So it's at the end of this administration, it is not a pretty picture.
I take your point about the fact that these reports are not really being released to the public. It seems to me though that one way or another, significant details do manage to get out.
Absolutely,
people do find out about the things that are in them. So I'm sure that it's hard. I'm sure that in Washington, it's hard to keep a secret about anything. But these things, it's apparently very difficult to keep the lid on these things completely because enough people know about them so that that some word does get out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that it's there is some incentive in government to really show what the U.S. intelligence, the spy agencies, think about what's going on there. This is an issue that, you know, where there's a significant amount of U.S. troops in this country. There's a significant amount of American money that goes to this country. So, I mean, I think there's some view that the American public is owed a very candid assessment of the situation there. And especially as, you know, with the end of the Bush administration, whomever wins in 2 weeks in the election is going to inherit a situation that, as I said, the trends are going kind of in the wrong direction. And that person will not have much time at all to sort of implement a policy to try to reverse those trends.
Yeah. So when talking about Iraq, I think that a lot of people, again, I think that this is true no matter whether they thought it was a good idea to go or not. I think a lot of people, their big question is, well, how can we get the troops home? I mean, when and how can we start to withdraw troops? And when you say that at the same time, I think a lot of people acknowledge the fact that there's going to have to be some American presence there for a long time. And some people talk about 5 years, 8 years, 10 years. If you talk about Afghanistan, and ask the same question, even if things start going better, even if we do those things that some people think we could do to improve the situation, how long does anybody think we would still have to be heavily involved in Afghanistan?
It's going to be a while, I think. And I think that if you look at the campaigns, you know, it's sort of an article of faith for both the McCain and Obama campaigns that we need more troops in Afghanistan. So so that if either of these guys, when they get elected, they're pledging to increase the U.S. presence there, not decrease it. So, you know, separate and apart from what happens in Iraq, I think the situation in Afghanistan, at least if you believe what both campaigns are saying, there's going to be a pretty significant U.S. presence there for some time, and there's but that doesn't mean there's not debate among experts and intelligence analysts about whether more troops is really the right way to go.
Well, how many troops are there now there?
There's around 20,000 or so. That's been the sort of baseline number. That number is starting to go up. So it's certainly a fraction of the number that have been in Iraq. And President Bush has said that he wants to send three brigades of troops, which is another about 8,000 to 10,000 troops.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, I'd just like to very quickly reintroduce, is Mark Mazzetti. He's national security correspondent for The New York Times, and we're talking about Afghanistan. And if you have questions, comments, they're welcome. We just, again, hope that people will be brief, but people are certainly welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of you're talking earlier about this, the National Security Assessment that looks at Afghanistan, that's sort of now in process, and we've certainly have heard some things about what's in there, and that there are these three big problem areas that they look at. That is the problem of militants operating, attacking in Afghanistan, but essentially being based in Pakistan and coming over the border to make their attacks and then going back. The issue of government corruption, the issue of the drug trade. I think at the time that Hamid Karzai came in and his government became constituted, I think there at least was some sense of optimism that this was positive and this was an opportunity to move forward. Why is it, do you think, or maybe what is it the thinking about why it is that the Karzai government hasn't been more successful?
You're right, certainly, that in the early years, it was seen that, you know, Hamid Karzai was the right person for Afghanistan, that he was a leader who certainly had good ties to the West, was someone who could try to unify a country that had been fractured for so long. And it's still difficult to say what has happened in the interim. I think there's a belief in Washington that in the last couple of years, his government, he's surrounded himself with the wrong types of advisors. His government has been very susceptible to, you know, frankly, corruption, frankly, to bribery, and taking kickbacks for contracts, and that he's put people out in the provinces where really it's so important to in Afghanistan to have good provincial governments. He's put people who are corrupt there. I think that there's no illusions that when you look at Afghanistan, which has such a fractured and troubled history, that you're going to ever have necessarily a truly functional or a truly strong central government out of Kabul that can control the whole country, nor would that necessarily be the right way to go. But you should have a competent government in Kabul that also is able to deal with the local territories, that can provide services to the people. Because in the absence of that, what's happening now is you're finding the Taliban moving into places, and they're providing the services, and they're becoming a sort of shadow government.
Mm. I was really interested to read this piece that was in the paper. I think it was just yesterday that included some conversation with the man who had been the top KGB guy in Kabul during the time that the Soviets were still there, and talking. And it was this sort of conversation, and you see it in other writing about Afghanistan. It's the sort of famous thing about the lessons not learned,
right,
and about how about successive generations of people who have tried to operate in there, the United States, the Soviets, the British. You know, you pick your outside power have in a sense always run into the same kind of problem, and that seems the sort of the conventional narrative as well. That tells you something about Afghanistan, its fractured nature, and the tendency of people to be essentially out for themselves and really have no sort of notion about, well, what would be the greater good of Afghanistan. Do you think that kind of narrative holds up? And I suppose the question is, well, if the answer is yes, then that really doesn't bode any better for the United States than it did for any other power that tried to heavily involve itself in the country.
I think that there's maybe parts of the narrative that are certainly apply. I mean, Afghanistan does have this history of fiercely resisting, you know, outside an outside presence. There are serious differences between, you know, the U.S. campaign and the Soviet campaign. I mean, the Soviet campaign had, you know, a couple hundred thousand troops there to really blanket the country, and it was a very violent and very, very bloody, protracted campaign of pacification in Afghanistan, and it provided kind of a rallying cry inside the country against the oppression. Now, the United States has been very careful not to keep ratcheting up the number of troops there, because that was the concern, was that you were going to follow the Soviet model. And I think even as bad as things are in Afghanistan now, there doesn't seem to be the feeling that, you know, the United States is like the Soviet Union, and that it is on a campaign of oppression, and that while certainly there have been large numbers of civilian casualties, they don't approach the number during the Soviet era. But that being said, as we just said earlier, there is talk of increasing the U.S. presence there. And the question is, okay, is that a good idea? And that's what is being debated right now, I think, not necessarily within the campaigns, but by outside experts. And one of the concerns is that what would more troops do in Afghanistan? If you accept that the most significant event in Afghanistan coming up is their elections next fall, what the new troops would have to do would be to sort of secure the country for the elections next fall. But then the question is one of timing. When the new president comes in January, will there be enough time to order more troops, train new troops, deploy new troops to Afghanistan, and have an impact to create a secure environment for the elections? Is there enough time? And that's a real question right now.
Just the fellow that I mentioned here, now I've got the article in front of me. His name is Zamir Kabulov. He was the top KGB man during the time that the Russians were there. Now, interestingly enough, he's the Russian ambassador. And maybe that's not strange. Just how much is Russia now involved in Afghanistan?
Not heavily. However, you talk to American military officials and intelligence officials, and they talk about how Russia is certainly watching very closely how the U.S. is operating in Afghanistan, and is looking for ways to influence the situation there. They certainly have obviously an embassy and a presence in Afghanistan, but not any kind of. There's not a direct military involvement, and you wouldn't expect it given the history there. But that it is, you know, and they see it right in their backyard, and so they see certainly as an issue where they would want to influence an outcome to some extent. So they're certainly not just passive observers in this case.
Another of the major problems that this report that we were talking about earlier has pointed to, and it's certainly gotten a lot of coverage, is the drug trade, that is heroin production in the country. What are the factors that have contributed to this after a period of time when it was maybe it didn't go away, but it was much less? It seems that in recent years it has come back. It has roared back very strong, and now some of the estimates are, I forget what the figure is. Oh, it's like half of the country's economy is the heroin trade.
That's correct. And it's, you talk to people in Washington, and there's certainly an admission that there's a real kind of failure of leadership, not only in the U.S., but across the board on this issue, that the United States and allied countries and NATO countries never really address this issue head on. In one case, the British were supposed to be in charge of the eradication efforts, and then the question is the right strategy eradication? Do you just try to destroy the opium crop and without any real plan for what are you going to replace it with? I mean, this is the livelihood for a significant part of Afghanistan's population, and so if you just if you take a policy of poppy eradication, well, what is your plan to replace the crops or replace these people's livelihoods? And there's never been a real plan for that. And so the feeling is that, you know, you should never judge a success for a heroin strategy of, well, how many acres of opium did you destroy? The benchmark should be, well, how many acres of new crops have been planted around the country? I remember traveling to Afghanistan in 2004 in the spring with a special operations group, and they had a base in eastern Afghanistan. I mean, outside of their base was just miles and miles of poppy fields, and they walked through the poppy fields every day, and they didn't see it as their job to get rid of the crop. Far from it. I mean, they were trying to win hearts and minds, and the last thing they wanted to do was destroy the livelihood of the villagers. So it's a very difficult issue, one where there's never been a real solution presented thus far.
Let's talk with someone who is listening here, someone who is in Champaign and on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have a couple of questions that may be basic to you, but as I listen to the presidential candidates talk about Afghanistan, even especially Senator Obama and some of his surrogates, I get the impression they are trying to draw a dichotomy between Iraq being a bad war and Afghanistan being a good war. And so I want you to comment on this good war versus bad war dichotomy. And secondly, what is our mission now, or the United Nations group of nations in Afghanistan? What is the mission of Afghanistan, and does this mission embrace encroachments upon the sovereignty of Pakistan to get after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
All right.
Two very good questions. First of all, the idea of the good war versus the bad war is sort of a narrative that primarily Democrats have been advancing, the idea that the United States was attacked on September 11th. The threat came from Afghanistan. It was good and right that the United States responded by going into Afghanistan. And yet, so that was the, quote, good war. And then the United States or the Bush administration took its eye off the ball when it decided to go into Iraq, and that so much time, resources, manpower was devoted to Iraq. In the meantime, Afghanistan has slid backwards. There is, I think, some legitimate truth to the fact that the Iraq focus has drawn attention away from Afghanistan inside Washington, and I have several people I talk to who work on Afghanistan policy who for several years were quite they were pulling their hair out that they felt like they never got high-level attention to the issue. And as one person told me for the story we wrote last week, he said, you know, the only good thing about hitting rock bottom is that you get attention, and now at least there's attention. The second point about Pakistan is that is one of the primary issues, is how do you deal with security in Afghanistan when you've got what the intelligence community says is a safe haven over on the other side of the border in Pakistan. And your caller brought up the sovereignty issue. We are seeing, not that they are NATO-blessed operations, but you are seeing attacks inside Pakistan by the CIA doing these remote predator drone aircraft. These are happening at an amazing clip. I mean, they're not publicized really, but you will not see a week go by without one of these. And this has been going at this rate for a couple months now. You've also seen at least one American Special Operations mission inside Pakistan. And this is a real point of tension between the United States and Pakistan, who in Pakistan is a U.S. ally and one a country the United States relies on, and you have American troops operating in Pakistani soil. So it is very delicate right now.
We're just about at our midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and we're going to continue to talk with our guest, Mark Mazzetti, in just a moment. He's national security correspondent for The New York Times. We would like to pause just long enough, Mark, to remind people who are listening that we're raising money for the station here. It's the money that will pay for next year's programs. We try to make these fundraising, this on-air fundraising, just as short as we possibly can. The reason we're doing it in the first place is that we found it's the best way to reach people who aren't current friends, aren't current supporters. And we also know that people would like us to spend as much time doing the programming, so we want to do that too. And we've made these as short as we possibly can. This is the last day. We'll be done today. So we really want to reach out to folks who are listeners but not supporters and say this would be a great time for you to make an investment in the programming that you enjoy. Could be as much as $1 a day, could be $10 a month, could be $1 a week. You know, you can make that decision, but the more important decision is that you're going to become a supporter of the station. Martha Diehl, she's one of the producers for Focus 580 and is now in studio with me.
You know, David, we used that word investment yesterday, and I'm so glad you said it again today, because it's one of the things that in these uncertain economic times, we do depend on listeners' money, but it is a sound investment that they make when they contribute to WILL. And you know that with your investment, we will continue to bring you the news and information, the good, the bad, and the ugly. You can, if you're at your computer, point your browser to willpledge.org to make your contribution. Or you can pick up the phone and call 217-244-9455. How much you should you give? You decide the amount. Just do your best. That's what we try to do here every day in bringing you the programming that we do.
All right. Well, again, thanks very much, Martha, and thanks to the people who have already made contributions. And if you're not among them, well, we hope that you would do that. Maybe that's been on your list of things to do. This is the last day. Really easy to do. You can call us, and that'll take just a couple of minutes. Or, as Martha said, now I think more and more people are making their contributions through the website. So you can do that as well. Either way, we hope that we'll hear from you today. This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. And again, our guest this morning is Mark Mazzetti. He is the national security correspondent for The New York Times. You can read his stories in the paper. You probably have if you're a regular reader of The Times. You can certainly go to their website and read some of the things that he's been writing here over the last couple of weeks. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment to go back to a little bit to the two things that we were talking about there just before we took the break. I was interested then in, I think that it was in an editorial that was in the paper referring to the story that you worked on about this intelligence assessment, and it has to do with the dealing with drugs and the suggestion that perhaps there are some limitations that have been put on what NATO troops can do when it comes to going after people who are involved in the drug trade. Is there some way in which there are restrictions on what they can do?
That's one of the biggest things hampering the mission right now in Afghanistan, is that there are restrictions not only on drugs, but on any number of things regarding fighting the Taliban, creating security. One of the good things about an international coalition like NATO is that you have international support. The bad thing is that you have sort of a patchwork of different countries that all sort of set their own rules about the way that their troops are going to operate. And what they call them is caveats, the international caveats, where the German troops can go into an area, but they're not allowed to do X. Dutch troops can do something, but they can't do other things. And it's a headache for commanders to try to put together a policy, whether it has to do with the drug trade or going after the Taliban in some of the remote areas. It is a major problem now that they're trying to work out is how can you take some of these restrictions off, and how can you kind of what they call unifying the mission, where you are able to have all the troops kind of working under the same set of rules.
To back again to the problem of Pakistan, during the time the Taliban were in power, the government of Pakistan or elements within the government of Pakistan were heavily connected with and were supporters of the Taliban, and primarily, I guess, because Pakistan was interested in having a sympathetic or maybe even more than sympathetic government in Kabul, because, you know, Pakistan and Afghanistan have this very long border. So they were interested in having some influence in Afghanistan just for its own sake, also perhaps as a way of balancing power of India in the region. Today, are there still connections between, or are there important ways that Pakistan or maybe the intelligence service in Pakistan is still connected with or supporting the Taliban?
Very good question. Very difficult question. The answer is probably yes. There's probably there are probably connections of some sort between elements of the intelligence service called the ISI and militants in the tribal areas of Pakistan. The history, in a nutshell, is that these militants or that the tribesmen who have been in this tribal area have long had these contacts with the Pakistani intelligence service. The Pakistani intelligence service has seen them in a way as an asset. They are a buffer between Afghanistan and the settled parts of Pakistan, and they've seen them as a strategic asset against Pakistan's primary rival, India. Pakistan is much smaller than India and has a smaller military than India does. And they've seen these militant groups historically as a way to sort of hedge against India. They've trained some of these militants against attacks in Kashmir. And so there's a long history there. Now, the question is, then if they take a step like having a hand in the bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul, that is something that was sort of considered as the last straw within Washington, where you have a Pakistani intelligence taking a role in bombing a capital of Afghanistan, where the United States has this very large strategic interest. It was something that, you know, maybe people think is unfathomable, but you think about Pakistan's situation, it's something that they think is sometimes necessary. Now, the current situation is that there's been a bit of a purge in the intelligence service. The Pakistani government has said they will not tolerate ties to the militants, and they've put a new head of the intelligence service in. Well, we'll see what happens, and we'll see how this plays out. Certainly, there's a question of whether things are done just for public consumption or done to appease Washington, and so it's really hard to make a firm judgment on that.
The relationship between Pakistan and the United States has been a delicate one for some time. The United States has needed the cooperation of the Pakistani government. We needed it back in the day when the Soviets were still in Afghanistan, because that was our conduit to the guerrillas that were fighting the Soviets, and we continued to need their cooperation. There was sort of a dip in our interest in this region, which then came back after 9/11, and so now we need the cooperation of the government because of terrorism. So that really puts the U.S. in a very difficult position that doesn't seem to have really a lot in the way of leverage over Pakistan, because the Pakistan can always say to us, maybe they don't even have to say it, look, you need us more than we need you.
And this is a, you know, for lack of a better word, it's a game that's been played for several years. I mean, the President Pervez Musharraf, who's no longer president of Pakistan, for years developed a fairly close relationship with the Bush administration, in part because after September 11th, he sided against the militants, and this was seen as a very bold, very gutsy move on Musharraf's part. And he kind of convinced Washington how essential he was to the whole situation. And in exchange, Pakistan got billions and billions of American dollars. The one piece of leverage the United States still does have is the money, but it's true that the Pakistani government does have hold cards, in the sense of the extent that they want to go after the militants themselves. Sometimes they're strong on it, sometimes they waver, and they are currently engaged in a pretty serious military operation inside the tribal areas, and we'll see what becomes of that. But your point is a good one. It's a troubled alliance between the United States and Pakistan. It's a necessary one, but it's one where over the last several years you've seen a pretty effective campaigning by it was President Musharraf to show how much he was needed by Washington.
Let's talk with another caller. We have someone here in Champaign County where we are. It's line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if you covered the RAND report that I'm understanding suggested that they decided there wasn't a military solution to Afghanistan. I'm curious if they'll ever come around to that on the Iraq front, but a solution that is acceptable to the bulk of either of the peoples there is probably a no-starter for either political party or the condominium of U.S. power.
I did not read the RAND report in detail, but I know what you're talking about. I know that some of the conclusions that they that were discussed. When you hear about the idea of a military solution, I think that is it's a good point to make. Usually, what they'll say is there's no pure military solution. In other words, you're not going to send enough troops there or have an effective enough military campaign that will solve Afghanistan's problems. And in fact, really, the military issue is probably only a small fraction of what needs to be done. It's got to be part of a larger strategy. And I think one of the things that that really people feel has been missing for several years in Afghanistan is that there was no overarching campaign. There was no clear strategy for, all right, how are you going to not only keep the Taliban from coming back, but you're going to provide the services, you're going to develop the economy, you're going to create functioning government, that this kind of the policy drifted for so long. And this is something that they're working on now. The one positive aspect is that people feel that with General Petraeus, who was running the Iraq mission, now is the head of Central Command, which means that he has overall control of Afghanistan, is that he brings the sort of overall counterinsurgency doctrine to Afghanistan, and that if you think that there's been some successes in Iraq, that he might be able to bring some of this to Afghanistan. But yeah, I mean, it is Afghanistan really is so much more than just a military problem. And it's just in terms of basic infrastructure. I remember a couple of years ago, you would drive this one road that connected Kandahar and Kabul, which was the sort of big success. You could drive along the road, and there could be commerce along the road, and it was a success story. Now I'm told, I haven't been there back there in some time, that the road is almost impassable because if you drive along it, you will be attacked. So it's things like that that have to be dealt with.
I heard it was impassable because it's just so blown up.
That's right. There's so many. You can't go 30 feet without having a crater. And so that is, that will really shut down a level of commerce there.
Yeah, the whole Afghanistan situation seems to me doomed from the start, in the sense that the way the U.S. did it, without maximum Powell sort of force, which I didn't advocate, but they did it by paying the warlords. The warlords are still in pay. Iran was even called in to help with aid to the Northern Alliance. So, they went a long way to doing it without a lot of U.S. troops, because I think they already did have their eye on Iraq. That's my figuring, anyway. There's just the nature of that. There's one anecdote from the early days when, which showed that Karzai is just really not in control. He wanted to put a certain governor into the Kandahar province, if I recall correctly, and the U.S. Special Forces were down there, and they put in this guy Sherzai. Karzai put him out later, but then had to put him back in. So there's, he's beholden to people that. A lot of people want to blame Karzai, but he's really a victim, it seems to me, of this construct of the warlords, et cetera, et cetera. I was wondering if you'd comment on some of that.
No, you know your history very well, and I mean the issue of the warlords is one that's always front and center. It's after September 11th, certainly people who fought to oust the Taliban, many of them felt they were then entitled to positions in the new government. So you had, you know, a warlord in Kandahar, you had a warlord out west, you had a warlord up north. And the question is, well, how do you move from this warlord structure to more like a functioning central government? And I think that's the problem. And then you have added to that a layer of this sort of patchwork of tribes in Afghanistan and ethnic differences in Afghanistan that it makes it very difficult to have a really cohesive government or centralized system. And I think that there is a belated recognition in Washington about that, and the feeling is, well, if we're going to arrest these sort of bad downward trends, you have to focus much more at a local district level in order to be able to sort of, you know, provide the services, provide security. That's what's really needed right now.
We have just about 10 minutes left. I hope the caller won't mind if I go on, because I have two others and I want to try to get them in. Next up is Urbana and line two. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Whenever we get involved with these kinds of wars, which are basically insurgencies, we always end up having to, as you said, the infrastructure problem, you know, you do a lot of damage, and then, you know, this thing's been gone for like 6 years now or 7 years now. You have a lot of problems with the fact that you can't, as the earlier caller stated, you really can't go in with maximum force, because if you do, you have to kill a lot of people, which is supposedly like World War II, when you basically had total war where you just kill everybody that got in your way and took over the land, you know, seize the property, seize the land, and then basically turn into, you know, like a military governorship for a while. So we're basically stuck in these sort of endless wars. And the point about the Soviets losing, well, if they did lose, was the Americans, you know, the American involvement, the Charlie Wilson analogy would be the film of the book about him, where you have this, you know, we basically got, well, I think we developed the Taliban through the Pakistanis. But my concern about the Pakistan is that the fact that they're a nuclear power, you know, with 30 or 40 warheads, sort of destabilizes the whole region, because if they fall, you know, if the insurgents take over or whatever, turn it into a mess, what do you think would happen with that? I mean, I know your specialty is Afghanistan, and I've read your stuff, and it's really interesting. I read the New York Times all the time. But I'm wondering how, when we get involved in these things, why everybody has, they sort of dance around the idea of, well, how far do you go? How many people do you kill? I mean, do you wipe out whole regions? Because we have the capacity to do that. Because when I was in Southeast Asia about 39 years ago, I was on the Cambodian border, and we would cross over, and illegally, it turned out later. But it was like you never could do enough damage to sort of solve the problem. So you have this old 1950s, 40s total war concepts built into the military, but you don't execute them. So how do we deal with that conundrum? Could you comment on that? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that certainly the leadership in the military, the United States military, does understand that you're not going to kill your way out of an insurgency. I think that they tried to, you know, those were lessons that were hard learned, and you're not going to kill enough people to, you know, kill every insurgent. And that's where this adoption of the sort of counterinsurgency doctrine of moving in to places, holding territory, building up local armies, and fighting that way. I think that there is a recognition that is the way out, but it's not easy, and it's something that takes, you know, a period of several years. So that is something that is not a short-term solution. I think that your point on Pakistan is a good one. The nuclear arsenal is something that is always of concern. That, you know, what would happen if militants got a hold of the nuclear arsenal? I think that, and certainly that's something that people in Washington pay attention to. I think that is really, because I do cover Pakistan a lot, less of an issue, because you have the strongest institution in Pakistan is the military, and the military is not at all beholden to the militants, and I think that there's safeguards in place that the military would prevent that from happening. But it is interesting, because I think that this is one of the things that President Musharraf it was kind of a card that he played in Washington often. He sort of raised the specter of the militants with nukes as a way to sort of shore up his own support in Washington, saying, well, you know, if you don't want to deal with me, look at the alternative. And I think that was a sort of it was a little bit of a threat that he used very effectively, I might add, to keep Washington behind him.
Again, I hope the caller will forgive me if I go on and get another caller. This is also someone, Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Well, I realize it's a very short time. I wish you would go back a little farther in Pakistani history. There have been a series of military coups in Pakistan's rather short history, and in each, the CIA and the British as well seem to have played prominent parts. Certainly the Pakistani people believe this. And it's had a profound influence, I suspect, in the failure of Pakistan to develop coherent democratic governments. Would you comment on this? Thank you.
Well, I don't know about enough of the history or of the agency's involvement specifically in the most recent military coup, which is to put General Musharraf in. I know certainly that on the Pakistani street there are all sorts of theories about American involvement in their own domestic affairs. That's certainly true, and. You know, you also encounter the problem in Washington is that, well, you know, you want to promote democracy, but in Washington's view, or at least in the Bush administration's view, it's a lot easier to deal with a military leader. And, you know, it may not be the best thing in the world, but you may like democracy, but democracies are messy. And I think that's what one of the things that they're encountering now. You have a civilian government in charge. There's different power centers. It's unclear how much control the civilians really have over the military. And so, you know, it used to be with Musharraf, you would ask for something and it was up to him whether to do it or not. Now I think the concern in the White House and elsewhere is that if you ask these civilian leaders to do something, they're not even sure whether they have the real power to do it. And so that is just a fact of nature in Pakistani politics, because the military is so powerful. I think no one is secretly hoping for another military coup, but it's certainly there are a lot of questions about the strength of the civilian government.
Mm-hmm. We're down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. Again, if someone wants to get in here real quick, we'll try 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I guess I'm coming back to around to where we started, and the fact that things don't look particularly good at this moment. Do you think that there's much reason here for optimism?
I think that yes. I mean, I think there is reason. No one I've talked to says that, you know, it's a hopeless situation. Pull everything out now and just let Afghanistan fail. I think that it is certainly it's a pretty bleak situation, but I think the feeling is that there is not it's not a country that is desperate for the Taliban to take over. I mean, they've been down that road before. It's not like the United States is trying to prevent an inevitable Taliban takeover because that's what the people want. I think it's a question of how do you you know, use resources in the right way. How do you develop a strategy that not only encompasses the military aspect but the development aspect as well? And so I think that there is hope that if there are military leaders in place, and that at least the new president will be recognizing that this is the front and center problem on his agenda when he takes over in January. That is, I think, at least reason to hope.
Do you think that sometimes we maybe focus too much on the issue of the Taliban as if to suggest, well, if it wasn't for the Taliban, if they were gone, or if they could just be brought into the government, that everything would be okay?
Yeah, the Taliban is certainly not the only issue. They probably present the biggest threat to the government in the sense that they continue to take over more territory by the day, but that's not the Taliban itself is not a monolith, and there's different factions within the Taliban. So the question is also, can they be exploited? I mean, it's an issue of you know, Afghanistan is effectively the poorest country in the world right now. So it's how do you basically rebuild a country and how do you provide basic infrastructure and basic services that can then be a foundation for rule of law? Those are the things that people recognize that you need most. And the security is one aspect of it. You have to provide security in order to build institutions. So these things go hand in hand.
Well, given just what you just said about the Taliban, the fact that it's not monolithic and perhaps there are factions or different groups within it, is it actually reasonable to think that that some elements of the Taliban could be brought into the government?
I think so. Yes, I think that there is discussion now about what are there quote unquote reconcilable aspects of the Taliban or parts of the Taliban that you could be brought in. There's some that could be. There's some that could not be. It's hard to paint with a broad brush just the Taliban. And so I think if there are some groups that are willing to be in discussions and to be brought into some government, I know that they're looking at that possibility.
Mm. Just any last thought maybe you might like to leave with folks just before we let you go?
Well, I think that there is also a recognition, and we've talked about Pakistan, we've talked about Afghanistan, that you can no longer just have two separate policies. It's not we've got to deal with the Pakistan situation or the Afghanistan situation. It's one situation. It's a regional approach that deals with Pakistan's tribal areas. Pakistan, by the way, is having its own dire economic crisis right now, and deal with Afghanistan. It's a regional issue. You can't separate the two. And so I think the next president, whomever that's going to be, is going to have to recognize that you develop a policy in tandem. You don't separate the issues. And so that, I think, is something that there does seem to be recognition, I think, in both campaigns on that issue.
All right. Our guest is Mark Mazzetti. He's national security correspondent for The New York Times. You can look for his pieces in the paper. You read the paper, you can go back to the website and see some of the things that he's written recently. Mark, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.